Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy. We're here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longtime food, health, and environmental journalist and reporter, and I report on the intersection and all the overlapping areas between how our health is affected by food and our environment. You know, we think a lot about personal health and what we can do to make better health choices, live a healthier lifestyle, but we also need to be looking at the bigger picture, what we're doing in our neighborhoods, communities, what we're doing in our society, what we're doing globally on planet Earth, because all of the larger frame decisions that we make together as citizens impact not only our health, but the health of future generations. That's what we talk about every week on Connect the Dots. And I also covered this in my blogs on Alternet and the Huffington Post, as well as my own website, healthjournalist.com. So every week we talk with different experts, advocates, authors, and thought leaders about all of the different things that you know, the choices we make as a society and how they impact our health and what we can do about it. So this week we are returning to a topic that I've covered a great deal since beginning our radio program about 4 years ago. We're coming up upon the fourth year anniversary, which is very exciting. And that is fracking. We've covered a lot fracking in the Northeast. I know when we began reporting on it back in 2009, people were kind of like, huh, what? Now I know that most of my listeners are much more well acquainted with it. We've done a few, just one or two shows in the last couple of months, returning to that topic because we cover a wide range of things here on this program. And we're going to do another one today, which is really relevant and fascinating. I know many of you know what fracking is. It's hydraulic fracturing, drilling for gas, using chemicals, and drilling deep into the geology. You know, for many of us, for many years, that's kind of an abstract thing. But we're going to learn a lot more about it and what's really going on there. And this has particular reference to the issue of whether or not there'll be fracking in New York State, which is something we've covered a lot on the show. I am really thrilled today to have with me for this program and for you to hear directly from someone who is one of the, if not the, top leading expert in what this really entails. He has a depth of knowledge in this area from his work as an engineer and his interests as in geology. He is the Dwight Baum Professor of Engineering and a teaching fellow at Cornell University, Dr. Anthony Ingrafia, PhD. He's a concerned scientist and engineer who engages beyond the academy to inform and educate the public on critical scientific issues that involve the public health and safety. He's also the president of an organization called Physicians, Scientists, and Engineers for Healthy Energy. You know, we usually think that, you know, if something happens in Fukushima, I should take potassium iodide, or what food could I eat to detox and, you know, avoid radiation exposure. So, you know, we're always trying to avoid things, and it's not that that's a bad idea, but it's like if we avoid things on a larger public level and really think more about public health, we wouldn't be having to tap dance around so much as individuals. So we're going to learn a lot more about fracking in New York State and sort of a changed view of what that would mean, and, you know, some significant new downsides that have come to light about it that Professor Ingrafia will be sharing with us on the show. So stay tuned. Welcome to Connect the Dots, Professor Anthony Ingrafia. So great to have you here.
Thank you very much, Allison. It's an honor to be with you today.
I have followed your work for a long time. As you reminded me earlier, I even, you know, I've quoted you in many of the Huffington blogs that I've done, and, you know, really almost did one blog that was, an entire citation of a letter that you had done. You've been one of the leading experts in this, and I began reporting on it and broke the story on it in Huffington in 2009. So, you know, the issue is still with us. As we know from a recent program that I did, although fracking in New York State has not moved forward, there's still the potential that it could. And you know, when fracking first showed up in the news media, it really was kind of discussed as a battle between upstate neighbors that had really few implications for people outside of the immediate areas and regions. Since then, you know, we've learned that fracking chemicals can migrate. The areas proposed for potential fracking are in the regions of New York City's watershed, which gives us our wonderful water. So, you know, because a lot of our listeners, I think, are also New York City oriented, before we kind of delve further into some of your new findings in this area, could you just give a bit of your understanding of the risk to all residents of this region, whether they reside in, an area that is on the possibly to be leased and fracked list or not?
Sure. I think it's important that your listeners, I'm sure many of them understand this, but they all understand that when you and I use the word fracking, we don't just mean something that happens 5,000 to 7,000 feet underground for a few hours on a well, because people in downstate would say, well, what could that possibly have to do with me?
Mm-hmm.
But we've come to understand that fracking as a word is really a placeholder for shale gas development
mm-hmm.
in New York State. We all know that fracking has existed in New York State for decades. There's fracking going on in New York State right now. But there has never been, and I hope there will never be, shale gas development. And as soon as we expand the conversation to say, well, let's talk about the potential impacts for health and wealth of people downstate from shale gas development, the conversation gets a lot more interesting and a lot more relevant. Because now we have to deal with things like pipelines. We have to deal with things like compressor stations. We have to deal with things like processing units. Tremendous amount of transportation of waste products and chemicals and equipment and hardware. And we have to also concern ourselves with, if it were to happen upstate, what happens to the gas that comes from upstate? Is it going to get exported through a liquefied natural gas terminal that's going to be built off of Long Island? All these things are very, very relevant to people all over the state. Doesn't matter whether it's upstate or downstate. We all live downstream and downwind of all the impacts from all of the other aspects of shale gas development other than fracking. I just want to make sure that the listeners understand that when you and I are having this conversation, we don't work in the industry for the industry and have a very narrow, myopic view that the word fracking only means a few hours during which thousands of feet underground pre-existing joints are being reopened so that gas can flow out of them.
Mm-hmm.
When we restrict our conversation to that level of detail, it's not surprising that people downstate would say, what's that have to do with me?
Mm-hmm.
I hope I answered your question.
You did. Thank you. That was exactly the context I wanted to set up for people, because I think that's where, you know, there has been a kind of a disconnect for some people. So, you know, basically, do you want to give a brief update of what the current status is for shale gas development in New York State? What, you know, as you say, some forms of fracking, maybe those that don't use these high volumes of toxic chemicals with water, have been done for years, you know, but this major new form of development as we now know it over the last decade or so is something else. What is the current status, just for listeners who are tuning in may not be acquainted with this?
Sure. The current status is that any oil or gas operator that seeks to produce oil or gas in New York State is mm-hmm. perfectly free to apply for a permit to do so mm-hmm. in any other rock formation using any other technique they want other than low permeability shale formations. That's the very strict definition that New York's DEC has used to differentiate between what we now call traditional oil and gas development in New York State and non-traditional, not to be confused with conventional and unconventional. There's a lot of terminology here that can be very confusing to the mm-hmm. public, so I'll try to clarify things for you with this answer. Let me repeat. There is oil and gas production, development, drilling, and fracking going on in New York State right now. But there is no production of natural gas or other hydrocarbons from shale formations. There is horizontal drilling going on in New York State right now because it's perfectly plausible for a company to use some form of non-vertical drilling to get access to oil or gas that is not in a shale formation. But I'm repeating for emphasis here, current de facto moratorium, which has been in place in New York now for over 4 years, prohibits the development of gas or other hydrocarbons from low permeability shale formations. So that's where we are, and that's what differentiates New York State from many other states in the country. As you know, some states in the U.S. have prohibited shale gas development. Others are in moratoria or de facto moratoria. New York State alone has been in that state, that condition, for a long period of time. You and I know there's an old phrase, it holds equally well in hydrocarbon development as in any other endeavor in human experience. Fools rush in. We know that our governor is no fool, and just as importantly, the people of New York are not fools. So whereas other states, some very nearby, shall we say, opened the barn doors way too early, and are now suffering the consequences because of CEQA law in New York State, the State Environmental Quality Review Act, New York State had to pause. And it's very wise that that law was on the books, and it was very wise of former Governor Patterson to execute or implement that law in this particular case, which caused us to be in the state we're in, which is a very good state to be in, considering all that we have learned in New York State from what has happened in nearby states like Pennsylvania.
So in other words, we can, having waited and watched, we can really see where the dangers are and, you know, and either call a halt to certain things or, you know, figure out different ways, you know, what we want to do and what we want to avoid. You know, one of the things that that's really been the prime driver of this in this terrible economy that we're in right now is the sense that you know, shale gas development, fracking, is going to create a huge boom. It's going to create jobs. It's going to bolster the economy. In Governor Cuomo's State of the Union address, he reiterated the very same point that he'd made in an earlier one. New York State is open for business. And so in people's minds, this has been portrayed as both providing an unlimited source of energy, albeit fossil fuel energy in a time when climate change is a mounting problem. And it also has been portrayed, and again, you know, by gas industry advertising and PR as a huge economic boon that's going to create jobs. And this has really been the driver, the two drivers, you know, why, you know, to kind of push our society to do shale gas development and to push New York State in that direction. You know, what is the reality that has unfolded over time about those two claims for natural gas?
Well, that is the excellent question for today, so I hope we have ample time to delve into it in some detail. The issue of shale gas development, particularly in New York State, has always been quite simply one of health versus wealth. Initially, it was perceived as, well, there could be wealth for the many versus health issues for the many. But what has happened in the last 4 years as we watched shale gas development occur in many states across the country, in particular in Pennsylvania, which is accessing the same shale formation that New York might access, the Marcellus, what we've seen is it's now devolved into the health of the many versus the possible wealth of a few. And that changes the dynamic. It changes the economic dynamic and the political dynamic. And so let me explain what I mean by that. 4 years ago, when New York's DEC started to develop its supplemental generic environmental impact statement, it had to do geological assessments of the Marcellus and the Utica and it had to do some amount of forecasting of how many wells, how many well pads would be necessary to develop a certain amount of shale gas in New York. Mm-hmm. Well, 4 years ago, we knew virtually nothing in New York about any of those aspects of the Marcellus Shale. How many wells would be necessary, how many pads would be necessary to produce a certain amount of gas. That was all based on speculation.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, honest speculation, DEC, in some cases, less than honest speculation within the oil and gas industry.
Mm-hmm.
So over the last 4 years, what we've learned is that the expectations, these speculative expectations of how much gas is actually in the Marcellus, in Pennsylvania, Ohio, West Virginia, Maryland, Virginia, and New York, keep decreasing. And they decrease because of increasing knowledge. Increasing knowledge born from increasing experience of drilling in Pennsylvania, for example, something like 7,500 Marcellus wells.
Mm-hmm.
And so New York has had the opportunity to observe from the Pennsylvania experience that just because you have Marcellus shale doesn't mean you have gas. And just because you have gas doesn't mean you have a lot of gas. And just because a well might be a super producer, what really counts on Wall Street is the bottom line. Companies can't just say our best well produces a lot of gas. They also have to say what the average well produces and which wells aren't producing very much at all. The flaw in the law of averages comes into play. So this is a long, drawn-out answer to your question,
mm-hmm.
but it is now pretty certain that the expectations, the speculative expectations of 4 years ago for New York State cannot possibly be borne out. There will never be 50,000 shale gas wells in the Marcellus in New York, not unless the gas price goes to some astronomically high figure. We'll
mm-hmm.
talk about that later.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, if there is gas and it can be produced, it's only going to be produced if the company producing it makes any money on it. So this all is a what engineers call a multi-dimensional problem where you have geology rules. You can't change geology. Economic rules, you have to have capital to drill a well. Infrastructure rules, you can't just drill a well and wish that the gas can get to some end user. You have to have lots of other infrastructure, pipelines, compressor stations, processing units, all of which also require capital. And you've got the political rule and the sociological rule. All these rules come into play in various, very complex fashions. And so what we've learned, this is summarizing what I just said, what we've learned from Pennsylvania is that there's extreme variability in the productivity of gas wells, even on the same pad, even within the same township, across a county. You can have wells that produce virtually no gas of economic value and wells that are astronomically valuable. So that begs the question, why? And it comes down to what I alluded to before, geology rules. Companies can expect that since there's tens of thousands of square miles of Marcellus shale, that as long as they get leasing rights on all those miles, they're all going to make money. That's an expectation. The reality is that geology will tell that company whether they're going to make any money or not. So tomorrow there will be a forum in Manhattan at the Society for Ethical Culture in which four very knowledgeable professionals across the spectrum, business, geology, engineering systems, gas production, will give presentations that summarize what Pennsylvania has learned over 7,500 gas wells and extrapolate what we've learned into New York through the lens of geology rules. And so geology rules, quite simply, in shale, because it's shale is a very, very difficult rock from which to extract gas. If it was easy, we would have been doing it 20 and 30 years ago. It's very difficult, which is why we've only been doing it for about the last decade in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And the two most important factors, parameters, geological aspects that determine whether a shale gas well will or will not be productive are quite simple. It's how thick that shale layer is and how deep it is. Those are geological aspects. We can't control those. Wall Street can't control them. Exxon can't control them. Nobody can control what geology says. And what we've learned is that there's a very, very good correlation that has been seen in Pennsylvania over thousands of wells between the productivity of the wells, how thick the shale is for a well, and how deep that shale is for a well. And here's the punchline. As you move north out of Pennsylvania, the Marcellus shale gets shallower and it gets thinner. I'm pausing for dramatic impact.
Yeah, there. I get it. So in other words, if you're not just kind of looking at as a Russian roulette, you know, who wins, who loses, it's like the Wild West, you know, I hope my well is, you know, it's like wildcatting or something. Mm-hmm. Now we really have the geological knowledge, the technological knowledge to really, based upon what has been seen, do an assessment. I mean, the point also about fracking is that people think it's been done forever. In this current form, what you're calling shale gas development, it has not been. It's only been 10 years. So at the beginning, there could be this kind of wildcatting expectation. And, of course, you know, Wall Street was going along with that and, hoping they were going to win big, too. But now with more knowledge, what you're saying is that the quality of the shale, the characteristics of the Marcellus shale as it comes into New York State means that it is inherently, in most instances, I'm gathering, far less productive. It's on the less productive end of the spectrum than what was hoped. How long has this been known?
Another excellent question. Industry experts have known this for a few years. Mm-hmm. There have been reports, documents, PowerPoint presentations at conferences that I've seen from within the industry that have produce the same sort of forecast that will be presented tomorrow to the public by non-industry people. So it's important that the public hear from non-industry people, that they will tomorrow, what the industry has known for a few years, that given today's prices, and I want to emphasize that, given today's prices for natural gas, the productivity of shale gas wells in New York will not be on average as great as the best places in Pennsylvania. And the best places in Pennsylvania are now just two. They're basically only three or four counties across the 20-some counties that have been drilled in Pennsylvania that are highly productive. And even now with those highly productive wells, the companies that own those wells, own the mineral rights to those wells, are not breaking even. They're still losing money. So it's important that that your listeners understand that geology rules, but economics also comes into play. If the price of natural gas continues to rise, as it has been, there are a number of ripple effects. As the price goes up, the availability of the gas goes up because companies will be willing to borrow the money necessary to drill a well, knowing that the price of the gas they're going to get out of that well and the volume of the gas they're going to get out of that well will pay for all the expenses and allow them a profit. So that makes wells that currently would be marginally productive or not productive at all at today's prices later will be productive at future prices.
Hmm.
So it's important that your listeners don't misinterpret what I'm saying, which is there's no gas in New York. I'm not saying that. There is gas in the Marcellus in New York. But given what we know about Pennsylvania and given today's prices, we're not going to see 50,000 shale gas wells drilled in New York in the next 10 years or in the next 20 years. I'm also mm-hmm. saying that all I'm saying right now is about the Marcellus. There are other shale deposits, notably the Utica in New York, about which something is known, but not certainly not as much as the Marcellus So I am not at all intimating that we can let down our guard, move on, stop thinking about shale gas development in New York. Far from it. We need to redouble our efforts now that we know more and can talk more intelligently and knowledgeably across that whole spectrum. We do know from the experience in Pennsylvania the range of health, environment, and climate effects. We do know from the experience in Pennsylvania who's going to make money, who's going to lose money. We do know that landowner coalitions in New York, for example, who have been very anxious to get development in New York started, are now going to learn that the worst thing they could possibly do right now is have somebody come on their property and drill for gas. The volumes aren't going to be there that they expected. Therefore, at the price that's current, they're not going to make any money. Ask the people in Pennsylvania who are not getting any royalty checks anymore.
So that sounds a bit complicated. It sounds like on the one hand, the people in New York, the landowners who think they're going to be the ones to hit the jackpot, could very likely be disappointed. But that, as they are now in Pennsylvania, which you're describing. But it could also be, though, that companies, because of the shifting price of the gas, still feel motivated, or will still have, an economic base, as gas prices rise, to come in, and drill anyway. So what does that look like, if they do that? In other words, it's not a boon then for the communities. It's not a boon. There are health problems. It's not a boon for the individual landowner. And yet it's possible the companies may persist in any event. What are the we only have a few minutes here before we break for station identification, and then we'll come back to this, but briefly, and we'll come back to it more after the break. What are the implications of that, of the companies coming in anyway?
Well, we need to talk about that after break, but let me just summarize one part of the complicated factors that we just talked about. That's the interplay between coal, natural gas, and prices. So if prices for natural gas go up, which is what the industry wants them to do, obviously, it's their commodity. They need to sell it, but they need to sell it at a profit. They will do anything to raise the price. Okay? One way to raise the price is to increase demand or decrease supply. So if they start exporting liquefied natural gas in the U.S., the price in the U.S. will naturally go up. What does that do? It makes coal for electricity generation much more attractive. In the last 12 months, coal has once again leaped ahead of natural gas as the principal way of producing electricity in the United States. That has a very, very bad health implication and a very bad climate change implication. So companies aren't thinking about climate change. Companies aren't thinking about health implications. Companies must think about their duty to their shareholders to return on their investment. So it does get very complicated. The geology rules, but the geology has to obey. No, wrong way around. The economics have to obey the geology. Coal versus natural gas. Climate change, health effects from emissions from natural gas, health effects emissions from coal, these are all very complex intertwined factors. Nothing is simple here, which is why we need to continue to educate the public, which is why the presentation tomorrow is one more additional huge input of knowledge that will enable us, enable the state legislature, enable the governor of New York to get a clearer understanding of what should be our path forward.
Let me just give a little information about that for people among our listeners who might be interested in going. That's tomorrow. It's Thursday, January 16th. It's at the New York Society for Ethical Culture, which is at 2 West 64th Street. The doors open at 6 p.m., and the event is between 6:30 and 9 p.m. You'll be moderating, and in addition, there'll be oil and gas experts Chip Northrup and Lou Alstadt, as well as geologist Brian Brock and systems engineer Jerry Acton. Actually, a number of New York State Senate and Assembly members are sponsoring this, as well as City Council members, along with the League of Women Voters of New York and a whole host of groups and coalitions, the Brooklyn Food Coalition, with which I've worked a great deal as well. This is really an important event, for our understanding, a rare and a very important event. I'll be there, and I urge anyone listening to come tell people about it. It's called New York Shale Gas Potential. How does it compare to Pennsylvania? We will now be taking a break for station identification. We'll be back with you in a few minutes, so please stay with us. Allison Rose Levy speaking with Professor Anthony Ingraffia about shale gas development in New York and what that really looks like from the perspective of geology, economics, and more. Stay with us. Welcome back to the second half of Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and we're here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. This is a program that we're doing about New York shale gas, also called fracking, colloquially, very often, and how it compares to Pennsylvania, and how the intersection between geology and economics really paints a picture of the lower expectations and perhaps higher risks that we may be facing if New York were to move forward with shale gas development, which is now stalled. My guest continues from the first half of the show. He's Dr. Anthony Ingraffia, the Dwight Baum Professor of Engineering at Cornell University, and he's also moderating a panel in New York City tomorrow, Thursday, the 16th, which if you're interested in this topic, you can learn more by attending. It's at the New York Society for Ethical Culture at 2 West 64th Street. Come at 6 p.m. For the event, which features a number of geologists, oil and gas experts, as well as moderation by Professor Ingraffia. If you're just tuning into the show, you can find the first half of the program in the Connect the Dots archives. And if you are returning to the show, which I hope you are, please pass this information and along to others. The show will be listed in the Connect the Dots archives. And also don't forget to like us on iTunes. Now going back to our conversation, Professor Ingraffia, one of the things I think it would be, kind of important to highlight is one of the things you've been saying in the first part of the show is that our expectations of productivity based on the geology of the shale gas in New York State have to be lower unless there's a kind of prices can be driven up through exporting the gas. So, we kind of can't have it both ways. We can't say we're having energy independence, and this is going to be a wonderful source of cheap energy. We have to bite the bullet, take the health and environmental and economic impacts that are not great at all. They're terrible, in fact, and I'd like to hear a little bit more about that. And we should go with it because this is giving us energy independence for 100 years, but what you're pointing out is that to drive the prices up, much of this gas will be exported, and then eventually, when those prices are up, we're going to be, paying dearly for them, and it's that those kinds of plans and assessments that the gas and oil industry is making in shale gas development. Do I have it? Is that a good summary of what we've been kind of talking about, just to, in case you want to tweak that a bit? And then I'd like to ask another question if we kind of feel like that covers it, or what do you think? What do you say, Professor Ingraffia?
Allison, I think that's an excellent summary that needs very little tweaking. I think it's just important that your listeners understand that shale gas development is a business. There are hundreds of operators. It's not just Exxon. There are hundreds of operators, and they're all trying to do the same thing for their shareholders, a reasonable return on their investment. It is not in the first interest of a shale gas operator to decrease impact on climate change. It's not in their first interest to decrease prices for the consumer. It's in their first best interest to increase profits. So shale gas is a commodity. right now it's at a price that's so low that it's below the break-even price for operators to produce it. That is the shale gas that's in New York. It's dry gas. For your listeners, just to understand what that means, it's just basically almost pure methane, which has very little value on today's market from the profit point of view. It can't make a profit producing it. It costs more to drill the well, to pay leaseholders, to pay royalties, to pay capital costs, to pay for all the infrastructure that needs to be built. That costs a lot more than the value of the gas that comes out of a well. So companies are going to do something else. They're either going to go drill for oil, which many have done. They've left Pennsylvania, or they go to the part of Pennsylvania where, in addition to methane, natural gas, they get what are called natural gas liquids, propane, butane, ethane, which are far more valuable in today's market. So New York doesn't have that option. New York doesn't have any wet gas. So it's a dry gas state only. No one's going to make a buck. No one's going to make a penny on producing shale gas in New York State right now until the price of gas, if the price of gas goes up. So companies will do what they can to make the price of gas go up.
What is the downside risk of their coming in to a region like New York where the gas is not slated to be that productive? There's not going to be that much of it based upon the analysis that you and the geologists have done. You know, what is the scenario then? If they persist and want to come in anyway, what would we be looking at if that were to happen?
The most important aspect of that scenario is what we call the ancillary infrastructure, everything else that's necessary once the well is drilled to get the gas to market. And no company is going to come into New York State. There's been a rumor floating around New York State now for a couple of years that there's going to be a trial balloon. One or two companies are going to be allowed to come into one county and drill 10 or 20 wells just to prove themselves. So that's lunacy. That's crazy. No company is going to do that because what are they going to do with the gas? It has to get to market. They're not going to voluntarily donate $5 million a well of capital cost to New York State just to prove that they're on their best behavior. That's just a crazy notion. They have to have gathering lines in place. Those are pipelines that connect every well to another part of the system, which is to dewater the gas, dehumidify it. It then has to be compressed, means it has to go to a compressor station. A compressor station is part of that ancillary infrastructure. It's a industrial unit consisting of very large horsepower, very noisy equipment that compresses the gas so that it can then go into a transmission pipeline at sufficiently high pressure. All that has to be built in order to get the gas to market. So the notion that a few wells will show that everything is safe is crazy. Companies will only come in and start drilling when they know that there's a way to get the gas to market, and that means pipelines, compressor stations, storage units, places to dispose of the waste products, solid, liquid, and gas, and hopefully, which we still don't have, a set of regulations for shale gas development and a set of enforcers of those regulations. We don't have those either. So what's the future for New York? Right now it's not obvious to me that there's any way that New York could invite or permit shale gas development even on a small scale in New York in the foreseeable future. It's just, it's not without substantial and continued development of infrastructure, which affects everybody. That's the first thing we said at the top of the show. People downstate will be affected as much as people upstate. Getting the gas to market means having that LNG facility somewhere around New York City and pipelines to that LNG facility. Getting that gas to market means a large number of pads, many wells, many compressor stations, hundreds or thousands of miles of new pipeline, mostly taken by eminent domain. So there you have it. You can have that, or you can have what we have now, which is New York State is smarter. New York State just reissued its future energy plan, its energy future plan, and it once again emphasized that New York State should increase its renewables capacity, should increase the pace of deploying renewables capacity, but unfortunately it still emphasizes a need for natural gas production.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll be talking about that with the governor in the future, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that you mentioned is that, you know, there's a kind of a seesaw between coal and gas, shale gas. You know, when one is high, the other is low. Can you discuss both their relative impacts on climate change from your understanding, as well as any comments you might offer about the I mean, of course, this wasn't occurring, but, you know, we recently had a this wasn't due to development, but there was recently, you know, a serious contamination due to coal in West Virginia, with, you know, over 300,000 people losing water. And it wasn't just, oh, I don't have a cup of tea to drink this afternoon. This went on for days and days. No one could bathe. If they touched the water, they had severe health impacts. I mean, can you kind of contrast, you know, the gas versus coal dilemma from the, you know, health and environmental perspective?
Sure. So let's talk about electricity generation in the U.S. Right now, something like 33-34% of all the electricity generation in the U.S. is done by burning coal. That is the worst possible way to generate electricity. It has immediate local health effects because burning coal produces very nasty things in the breathable environment. It is also very bad for climate change because it produces a lot of carbon dioxide. A year ago, we were producing a little bit more electricity from natural gas than coal because the natural gas price had been depressed because of its overproduction.
Mm-hmm.
But the natural gas price rose in 2012-2013, which brought coal back into the picture, and now we're producing more electricity from coal than natural gas. Now, one might falsely conclude that, gee, Professor Ngrafi is saying we should be producing more natural gas so that we can produce more electricity from natural gas. False. Because natural gas used to produce electricity is at least as harmful to climate change as coal. Not only does burning natural gas produce carbon dioxide, just like burning coal, even though it produces less carbon dioxide per unit of energy than coal, it produces more methane. And unfortunately, methane is a much more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide by a factor in the short term of, say, 20 years, by a factor of nearly 100. That means if you leak 1% of methane production from a shale gas well into the atmosphere, either purposely or accidentally, if 1% of it leaks, it's about the same thing as if you burned it twice.
Mm.
So right now there are studies going on all over the country from government labs, government agencies, prestigious universities, and industry itself trying to determine how much methane is actually getting into the atmosphere unburned. We don't know the answer to that question, but every single measurement that's been made in the last 2 years, we've only been making measurements for about 2 years, mm-hmm. every single measurement that's been made indicates that the amount of methane that's getting into the atmosphere unburned is much higher than the break-even point with coal. That is, the combination of carbon dioxide from burning natural gas and methane from not burning natural gas makes using natural gas for electricity production worse for climate change than burning coal.
Mm.
Therefore, your reader or your listener should be thinking, well, if we shouldn't be burning coal for electricity and we shouldn't be burning natural gas for electricity, what should we be doing for electricity? And the answer is obvious to all your listeners, and that is a very quick transfer from using any fossil fuel for electricity generation to renewables. And when I say quick, I don't mean overnight, I don't mean this month, I don't mean this year, but as quickly as we can within the confines of economics, standard of living, sociological acceptance, political will, political leadership.
Mm.
And we have all that in New York State.
Mm-hmm.
New York State can be and is rapidly becoming the lead state in making that transition quickly and effectively with no economic harm to its citizens.
Where do you, where do you see Governor Cuomo as being in these considerations? I mean, he has held off this long. Are these things that the governor of New York, is acquainted with? Is he familiar with some of the things that you're talking about?
Oh, I'm sure he is. I have never had a personal meeting with him or a personal conversation with him. I certainly have met with people in his administration. I've met with many people inside the New York State DEC. Governor Cuomo is very wise, very adept, certainly very politically savvy, and he knows these things. And what some people see as dilly-dallying, delay, I forget what phraseology some people use to try to describe what appears to be indecision. It's not indecision from my perspective. Mm-hmm. It's wisdom at work. Mm-hmm. As I said before, fools rush in. There is no reason to rush into shale gas development in New York State right now. There is no economic compelling economic benefit. There was a perception that that would be the case 4 years ago. But now going back about what we talked about in the previous part of the show, that was all speculation. And the industry has shot itself in the foot by overproducing natural gas and driving down the price. And unless and until they can raise the price back up again, there is no driving, economic, compelling reason for shale gas development in New York State, either from the state's coffers point of view, from an ad valorem tax, from an employment point of view, or from a landowner income point of view. None of those will accrue in New York State in the current environment. And if we do pursue this notion that industry will drive up the price by natural gas exports, what happens to climate change? It's all bad. We will be producing more natural gas that gets burned, and that's not good for electricity generation. We will drive up the price of natural gas, which makes coal better from an economic point of view for electricity generation. That's bad for climate change. And both are bad for the environment and human health. It's the wrong direction. And I think the governor knows that.
Well, that's really an amazing thing. You know, all along there's been this kind of, we'd like to go, originally at one point, shale gas development, fracking, was characterized as the bridge to renewables. And that, of course, is laughable when you talk about $1 billion infrastructure being built for, what some projections of Deborah Rogers and economic analysts and others show to be, only a dozen or a couple, decade or two of exploitable gas as opposed to the 100 years of energy independence. So that's not a bridge. And then, facing this either-or dilemma between gas and coal, is really kind of forcing the move in the other direction in the way that you describe. And this new understanding of the lack of productivity in New York, the quality of shale gas that's here, really lessens the rationale for doing it. That's what I'm seeing, and I just want to take a moment to once again encourage listeners, if you're in the New York New York City region, to come hear Professor Ngrafia in person tomorrow night, January 16th, at the New York Society for Ethical Culture at 2 West 64th Street. Doors open at 6 p.m. The event is 6:30 to 9. It's going to be very interesting. He'll be moderating a panel with a number of oil and gas experts, a geologist, and a systems engineer. And all that you're describing is really, how we look at a complex systemic infrastructural hopefully an asset, but maybe really, and as you're describing these new understandings, more and more of a debit, and move on that. What suggestions do you have for anyone listening to our program who could be interested in participating, you know, beyond, of course, attending this wonderful event tomorrow. What can people do to kind of help push things in the right direction?
Continue the process of self-education. Stay off the blogs, except yours. What I mean by blogs, I mean the personal blogs. It's okay to read blogs written by professionals for high-quality media outlets. But to the extent possible, read the high-quality reports and papers. And I know that's asking a lot from some viewers who aren't used to reading scientific papers, but read the high-quality reports and papers that come from reputable sources, universities, government labs, government agencies. Continue to educate themselves like they can do tomorrow night at the event that we keep talking about, where you get clarity in a very complex situation. You described it very well. It's a very complex, multi-dimensional infrastructure capability for the nation's energy picture. None of this is simple. Sloganeering doesn't work. Emotion doesn't work. Both sides of the issue, both those who are against shale gas development and the industry that wants shale gas development, say that all decision making should be based on the best available science. Mm-hmm. Well, where's that best available science coming from? It's not coming from right-wing talk radio. It's not coming from the extreme left, environmental wackos. It's coming from the central capability that we have in the U.S. to produce good science by having really good scientists and engineers and technologists and economics and economists and sociologists and legal minds investigate all facets of this highly complex situation and decide on the best course forward. That's the wise thing to do. The unwise thing to do is rush in before you have the knowledge and understanding. That leads to a very awkward situation in which, for example, the Obama administration finds itself right now, and some large environmental green organizations find themselves right now, of having to do science-based, instead of doing science-based policy, doing policy-based science. There's a big difference.
No.
You don't decide to do something on a large geopolitical scale, like shale gas development, and then hope that the science comes in on your side. That's rolling the dice. And effectively, that's what we are doing in many states, in the United States and in many countries around the world. We're just hoping that when the science gets done, the health science, the climate science, the economic science, that it's going to confirm our hope that when we roll the dice, we are going to get the number to come up that we wanted. That's just backwards. New York State is virtually alone, and perhaps mostly by choice, perhaps partly by accident, in being in a situation where we didn't roll the dice to begin with. We've given ourselves lots of time for the science, all the science aspects that I just mentioned, to be done here, in other states, and abroad, so that when it finally comes time for the governor to say yes or no, he will have the best available information available to make the proper policy based on good science. That's what he keeps saying he wants, and that's what he's getting.
Mm-hmm. You know, what you bring up is such an important point, and it's something I harp on a great deal, and we're coming to the end of our time here. But that is the difference between taking a precautionary stance and doing the science completely first, rather than taking either industry science or PR or hopeful phrases and then rushing ahead with something. I mean, this is a problem across many sectors, including this one, and if there's a theme to my reporting on the diverse niches that I cover, this would be really close to it. And it's something that people need to get away from the slogans and the sound bites and really get it informed and educated. So I hope listeners will do that tomorrow night, Thursday at 6 o'clock at the New York Society for Ethical Culture. Please join Professor Ngrafia and his panels there. Thank you so much for being with us today on Connect the Dots.
Thank you, Allison. It was a privilege.
Yeah, it's been wonderful to have you, and hopefully we'll have you back again as well.
I would look forward to that.
Well, thank you. Thank you, listeners, for being with us on this week's edition of Connect the Dots. Please share the show with your friends and come back and join us again next week at 10 a.m. Eastern on Wednesday, where we'll be talking with Dr. Wilma Supra about the health impacts of gas and oil development and infrastructures. Not to be missed. See you next week.
Oh my.